Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, deconstructing the myths around the pandemic of COVID-19. My guest, Professor Dolores Cahill, that's C-A-H-I-L-L. She is one of the world's most knowledgeable virologists, molecular genetic experts. She's a heavyweight. She received her degree in molecular genetics from Trinity College Dublin, her PhD in immunology from Dublin City University. She was group leader of the protein technology group at the Max Planck Institute of Molecular Genetics in Berlin. She co-founded the Protogen Research Laboratories. And she is a professor of translational science at the University College Dublin School of Medicine and Medical Sciences. Her research publications, and there are many in peer-reviewed journals, are on understanding therapeutic antibodies, biomarkers, discovery for validation of diagnosis, assay development. She is knowledgeable in all these. She's also on numerous editorial and scientific advisory boards and peer review literature boards. For many years, she has been involved in policy development in the areas of science, technology, and innovation, and including in the European Union, where she's a major voice for health, innovation, and infrastructure. And for the last 17 years, she's been a member of the Irish government's Advisory Science Council. That's be like our National Academy of Sciences. And she was also appointed by the Ministry of Industry, Trade, and Employment. And for the past 10 years, she has been a member of the Science Advisory and Review Boards and in Germany and United Kingdom and in Sweden as well. And she's received a lot of awards for outstanding work, including the very prestigious BMBF BioFuture Award from the German Ministry of Science. And she was awarded the Federation of European Biochemical Societies annual award for her research and its significance. So you're dealing with one of the most formidable scientists on the planet, one of the most respected voices. So listen carefully what she has to say. This is a discussion that she had on September 22nd, and in it, she is showing you what I've been reporting on for a long time, that the death statistics that have been the basis for all these political decisions to lock everyone down, to quarantine people, to have them not interface, to close down schools and businesses, to destroy the world economy, were all based upon misinformation. And also, she talks about how we should be able to build our immune system naturally. After all, she's a PhD in immunology. So she has some extremely valuable insights about the flu, about influenza A and B, COVID-19. You've not heard this information before. Now to Professor Cahill.
So I'm sorry I'm delayed. I haven't had a radio interview since May. You know, I was interviewed two or three times where they were saying, oh, this is dangerous what you're saying. And then I just had one this morning. It was supposed to be yesterday, so that's why I'm a little late. And it was in Cork. And he kept using words like conspiracy, and I didn't go there at all. So I suppose there's very good news. Can you hear me? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, there's very good news. The good news is that coronaviruses circulate 4 years out of every 10 years. So all of us, so 40% of the flus are coronaviruses, 30% of the common cold is coronaviruses. So what people are not taught and the doctors are not taught is that you have an immune system. And how you know you have, if you remember when you had chickenpox, yes. You would get chickenpox and you might be unwell and have spots or whatever for a week or 2 weeks. But what that is why you suddenly get better and then you are immune for chickenpox for your life, is that your immune system recognizes the virus and it kicks in, you feel unwell. And why you feel unwell is that to get rid of the virus, your body has to raise your temperature. And that raising of the temperature makes you feel exhausted and it makes you slow down, lie down, sleep. So it gives the energy of the immune system to defeat the virus, clear it, And then within, you know, 2 weeks or so, you'll recover. And you'll be fine. And your immune system, if you come across chickenpox again, will remember it. And you won't get the symptoms, okay? And you'll be fine. So what happens with coronaviruses is it's a virus that causes the flu, so 4 out of 10 years. They circulate the globe. And people come across coronaviruses, you know, every second year. And between 85 to 98% of people, no matter what age you are, won't have any symptoms. Because your immune system will recognize one or two viruses, will kick it out even when it's on the surface. So the virus won't get in your body, you won't even make an antibody, you won't even have symptoms. So someone like that, which is between 85% and 98% of the population, will be negative on all these tests because the virus didn't get into their body, they didn't make antibodies. But the main thing is the whole population see these viruses every winter, every single person on the planet, and after 3 or 4 weeks in a region, everyone will have either have had no symptoms, 9 out of 10, or the people who get illness are usually the people that make the antibodies, the 1 in 50 or the 1 in 10. And they will have antibodies, they might have had flu symptoms, and they'll be well. So what we have is we have an immune system. So this year we had influenza B circulating in December 2019. We had influenza A over Christmas, and we had coronavirus around January, February, March. Okay? So you might have remembered, I actually got all three of them. Okay? I got all three of flus. You might remember being sick before Christmas in January, I certainly was. And the symptoms of it, which wasn't spoken about at the time, were like you had flu-like symptoms. So I would be the 1 in 10, would say, people who actually got symptoms. And I was stressed because I was standing for election and trying to work and pushing back on all this stuff. So I got symptoms. So you would be a little bit breathless. You know, you had a cough. But these symptoms happen over, like, you know, well, with flu, it comes on quite quickly, as you know. And then if you don't recover and you get breathless, that whole process takes a week, you know? So the good news is, though, that, and if I had known, and that's why I came out, and this is important for other flu seasons, whether it's influenza virus or coronavirus, is that if you have good nutrition and you drink water and you sleep, you will actually help your immune system to attack the flu virus, right? That's common sense. But if you have poor nutrition, so the most important thing is nutrition, you know, but then you can supplement with vitamin D, C, and zinc, okay? So then if you do that over the winter season, especially zinc, that actually helps the immune system get rid of the virus. You're actually, if you don't have zinc, your immune system doesn't work very well. But then there are other treatments like inhaled steroids. And what they do is they just help your immune system attack it. So the treatments like vitamin D, C, and zinc, your own immune system will clear it. So you will have built up an immune response. And the beauty of that is when you see the coronavirus again, your immune system is boosted, so you'll have less symptoms, you know? And so what they're not, they are acting as if we don't have an immune system. And what I'm saying is use it like the analogy of chickenpox, right? Where you get sick for a few weeks and you're essentially immune for life. And so each time there's a circulating coronavirus, your immune system is very quickly going, oh, that's a coronavirus. It kicks in. You may not have any symptoms. You have flu-like symptoms and you're well. But the most important thing is for coronaviruses, which I'm saying these guys have picked the wrong virus to launch a pandemic, right? The same as carbon dioxide is the wrong molecule to do all this global warming thing. They didn't actually know the chemistry of it. So in coronavirus, it's seasonal, right? So the main impact of it is just between December and April. But in every region, people build immunity in about 6 weeks. You know, so in China, it was actually, we say it started December, January, February, but Nobel Prize winner Michael Levitt said on the 28th of January, 2020, that there would be a precipitous drop. The peak in China would be in February, and there would be no deaths in China from the 18th of March. He forecast that, right? Looking at the data as a Nobel Prize winner. And he was exactly right. There was no deaths in China. The peak was in February. So that's to tell you these ones are seasonal. And why? And so in Ireland, it came, you know, February, March. And when I did my Dave Cullen interview, if anybody saw it, there was a graph with three little peaks. And so one was a precipitous drop, but the first peak was influenza B in December, second peak influenza A, the third peak was COVID-19. But that's to remind you that flu is seasonal. And within a month in December, it meant that in the whole world, everybody got the flu, you know? It actually goes the way the earth circulates, China, Europe, America. And each region will have, everyone will get it within about 5 weeks. But what they're not telling you is, why is no one sick after 5 weeks of influenza in December? Is everyone has built immunity. So if you're still alive in January, every single person in the world has developed an immune response to influenza A, and we're all well. So what they're doing now is, like, if I set up a company, which I said on the radio station, and I started getting millions from the government to test people for influenza A now, right? We had it all. It was a flu in December. Everyone had it in the world. And if people who were dying of Alzheimer's, that I was testing them for influenza A, and the doctors were reporting the deaths, like everyone in Ireland would have come across it, about 1 in 10 would have made antibodies, 1 in 10 or 1 in 50 might be PCR positive, the rest aren't. And I started reporting cases of influenza A, a flu in December, that everyone had and everyone recovered from. And there's now this big media storm reporting cases of influenza A, when actually, guys, it was a flu, a winter flu, it peaked in December, it's gone now, we're all immune. So they are doing the exact same thing for COVID-19. It's a seasonal coronavirus. About 1 in 10 people had the symptoms. We're all immune. So they are now testing people who had it, were exposed to it, and they just have fragments of the RNA. But the testing, which we don't need to go into, may actually be positive if you have a common cold, you know, or another circulating virus. Just because they've had this media storm, like the way we had two influenzas, there could be another circulating coronavirus. So all the testing and cases, it's over. It's really a flu. And so I knew in March, so you can search if you want to write down, the World Health Organization, the 11th of March, 2020, when the Director General announced the pandemic. I knew straight away, you can read the second line, straight away I knew, he said, it had already gone to 114 countries. That means these viruses circulate the world, right? The governments are not going to stop them. People travel on airplanes, right? In the 11th of March, it had gone to 114 countries. That's just where they tested it. It had obviously gone in the whole world. But the number of deaths in December, January, February, March, when they declared the pandemic, in the whole world, 7,000 million people, was 4,291. So you had a chance of dying from COVID-19 of 1 in 1.8 million. Right. So you have a chance, like the people, so 56 people were dying every day of COVID-19. So every day in the world, 3,000 people die of TB. Every day. So for in the whole world, in 4 months, it was the equivalent of one day. TB is an infectious disease, right? So you had a chance of 1 in 1.8 million of dying, whereas 1 in 3 people die of cancer, right, in every family, right, 1 in 3 people. So that it actually, there was no reason to call a pandemic. And it turns out in SARS, the previous one, so how do you know as well, like, was this, should this be a pandemic? So the famous SARS, if you remember, SARS, in 2002, 2003, which they were, you know, flagging as a pandemic. In the whole world, there were 6 billion people at the time, 6,000 million people. In the whole world, guess how many people? I know it's hard to guess, but obviously all deaths are tragic as well. I'm not undermining. You know, 150,000 people die every day. But in the whole season, in 2002, 2003, 774 people died in the whole world from SARS. So you had a chance of dying back then of 1 in 1.8 million people. This is not 700 people died. That's like a few hours of one day of TB. The World Health Organization is calling, and that's all on the World Health Organization website, the 774 people. There was one person that died in Ireland back then, one, okay? This is not so, and okay, so it's not, these coronaviruses are rare. They're not something to close down the world for. They're not infectious diseases. And if you were going to close it down, there's like 50 times more people die of the infectious disease, just TB every day. 20 more people die of other kind of infectious flu-like symptoms every day. So there was no reason to do it. But the really good news is we have treatments. So it turns out that vitamin D can actually prevent about 85% of the deaths now if you get high dose vitamin C, vitamin D. Okay? So say next winter, if you have a bad flu, you can actually ask your doctor to get higher doses of vitamins C and D that will protect you. But there's also, you can ask for inhaled steroids, which are well proven. There's also some interferon, but of course there is the drug hydroxychloroquine, right? And hydroxychloroquine only works with zinc. It is a zinc ionophore, so it helps zinc work. So if you take zinc as a preventative dose, you're actually giving your immune system the building blocks. Because in the end of the day, no matter whether you get hydroxychloroquine or not, it's your own immune system actually provides the protective response. And in these viruses, you actually clear the virus, it's called, so that the virus particle, when your immune system works, the virus particle is gone and you're well. So the good news about hydroxychloroquine is it's on the World Health Organization Essential Medicines of the World. It's been approved 70 years ago. It's used in Africa for malaria. It's called the Sunday drug. It can be given to breastfeeding women, and pregnant women, and it can be given to children. And it works very well for malaria and for autoimmune diseases like lupus and arthritis. And it was previously known to work for coronavirus, and it was shown in China to work for coronavirus. So it's one of those. It works for arthritis and lupus. So what was shocking then in January or so is that that it was well known, it was working. And in some countries like France, it was in the newspapers, they gave it to a lot of politicians and the doctors, and then they destroyed the stockpile of hydroxychloroquine. And then in Ireland, they came out and said that doctors couldn't prescribe it. You can prescribe hydroxychloroquine for lupus arthritis the whole time. And then later on in around May, the FDA said to doctors that they could be struck off if they prescribed hydroxychloroquine, one of the safest drugs in the world. So they could prescribe it still for lupus arthritis, but not for coronavirus, right? And of course, the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons on the 6th of June, 2020, are taking a legal case against the FDA because this is the first time ever that a licensed drug for 70 years, one of the safest drugs as well, right? They monitor, has been withdrawn in the middle of a so-called pandemic for treating people. So I'm not sure whether it's allowed in the UK. So a lot of the time, I know in Ireland, you can prescribe it in Ireland for like arthritis and lupus, but there was a kind of a guidance from the manufacturing to say they weren't sure if it was safe, you know, even though it had been published. And then what is undermining, and why people like me are speaking out, this process is undermining the governments, right? Because if you have a treatment, so you know, the combination of nutrition, vitamins and zinc, and things, inhaled steroids, interferon, hydroxychloroquine, if you have a treatment and they were given to people who have the symptoms, 99.9% of people will not die, okay? So of course, if you have something then that probably the death as of now, you know, without treatment in Ireland, we now have 100 verified deaths from COVID in all of 2020. But if they had got treatment, probably all of them would have lived, right? So then that has two questions. And everybody knows this. The publications were known 2003, 2005. It worked in China in January, in February. So the doctors, what they were not doing was telling people about prevention and food and vitamins, but they were destroying hydroxychloroquine in some countries, and they were saying it used to be available, now it's not available. And then they were doing this lockdown for something that was not necessary. So the politicians and the medical advisors are hyping up something that is unnecessary if they made the treatments available, including prevention by food and vitamins. So it was known to be very rare, right? When they call the pandemic, the chance of dying is 1 in 1.8 million. So that's very rare. 1 in 3 people die of cardiovascular disease in Ireland, 1 in 3 of cancer, 1 in 3. So this is like a very rare, you'd have to be 60 years in Ireland on average when the pandemic called for one person to die. There was no basis on the data available to do the lockdown. But the good news is hydroxychloroquine, you can also do it as a preventative dose, one tablet a month from October to May. And it seems to also prevent symptoms of other flus like influenza. But of course, the most important thing is if you take vitamins and zinc. So it means less people may potentially die now because people are aware that they, you know, can actually boost their immune system. So then the other thing then I was doing when I was speaking out, I was asking for people to help me in Ireland. And I'm saying globally from the beginning that Ireland could actually change this whole thing in the world, right? Because when it's such a small country, when people die, we all know each other, right? So what I was saying is that if there is a treatment available, if the government, they are still reporting over 1,700 deaths from COVID-19, but if there's a treatment available, that we should be looking at all those deaths and asking the doctors, did you give them treatment? Okay? So they are, that means it's preventable, right? So we were then, with not me, but with a group of people, were writing, well, I was saying it, that people are writing. So it wasn't me, but they were liaising with me. And they were writing to the doctors, because you can look up at rip.ie, and write to the coroner. So we knew which regions or which shires or counties in Ireland had the most deaths. And we were writing to doctors and the coroners, you know, because they're public officials, to say, you have reported, you know, 500 deaths in Dublin or Kildare. Can you, you know, just reminding them that coroners have a duty, it's a legal process, to write the correct cause of death. So if someone had terminal cancer or died of Alzheimer's, then obviously that should be the cause of death. And if they, you know, not. So in the, and the same with doctors, we were just reminding them that it's a legal process and they can potentially be struck off, right? And we were publicly available saying it, so that you could actually go through each of the 1,700 deaths and look and see where, who, you know, what happened. So the good news is, on the 9th of September 2020, you can look up cso.ie, search vital statistics, Q1 2020, and you'll see, now I'm going to be publishing, I've written a report for it, but they have now said the number of deaths in Ireland, because we've been, you know, making it known that the number for 1,700 was exaggerated, and that doctors and coroners cannot be incorrectly ascribing. And hundreds of people contacted me and said, my elderly relative died of Alzheimer's, but on the death cert it says COVID-19. So we have already hundreds of people in Ireland that were willing to do a public inquiry and go through each of those deaths. But on the 9th of September 2020, CSO, Vital Statistics Q1, the number of deaths now that died of COVID-19 in December, January, February, March in Ireland is zero. Yeah, just because, so the first death was in April, right? That meant no death. Now, I'd been emailing as well and they confirmed it. But even though it's reported on the website 1,778, right, on Euromomo and World, our World in Data, they now came out and said the number of people. So, you know, it's like testing for the chickenpox or influenza A. All these big numbers that are positive on a COVID-19 test is just that they had influenza, you know, they could have died of something else. So in the CSO, and it's called the HSPC, the Health Surveillance Unit, have come out and said in a table, the number of people in Ireland, all 2020 that died of COVID-19 now is 100 in the whole country, 100. But of course, what we will be doing now, that only came out last week, is looking up each of those 100 deaths, because they were preventable deaths. And if they happened after April, the Zelenko protocol, you know, the Raoul in France were publishing that it was widely available that hydroxychloroquine worked. So those 100 deaths again. So we will be pushing back for the next one. They don't officially do the breakdown of those until November, but we will be making it known. We will be assessing each of those 100 deaths for the doctors, because if a coroner, you know, actually one of those 100 was not COVID-19, because of course, if the numbers are low, it doesn't justify the lockdown. And it doesn't justify the elderly being isolated, which there's no need for. And if there is a treatment available, they can be fine. Yeah? So that, but the thing is, because these viruses have similar about the region of, you know, I think it's 1.5 million, you know, in Ireland under 65. And then it's obviously 92 per million. But if you have a treatment, those deaths are preventable and the treatments are really effective. So therefore, the good news is there's no real scientific or medical basis for the lockdown. But for the next winter season, which is, I think, the pharmaceutical industry really don't want, is that hydroxychloroquine and zinc work for any flu immediately, right? So you don't need to wait a year for a vaccine. There's no panic. And it also seems to work for influenza, right, virus, so that you can take a preventative dose of 100 milligram tablet if you're over 65 or you feel you have underlying conditions. And it costs 10 cent to make, and you can usually get it for about 50 cent. It's very cheap. So you then, for other future sins, and of course then you don't need to take a vaccine because you've got a safe and effective treatment. But hydroxychloroquine works within 3 hours to 8 hours. So if you didn't want to take the preventative dose once a month, you could just say, well, if I'm, you know, because only maybe 2 in 100 people get symptoms. So if you never get flu symptoms, you don't need to worry. You don't need to be taking anything. Your immune system is actually boosted. But if you are the 1 in 10 or 1 in 50 that do get flu, then you can just have hydroxychloroquine available to you, or ask your doctor, will you prescribe hydroxychloroquine if I need it? And within 3 hours, the symptoms will be reduced. And what I'm saying to people is, if you don't have symptoms and you don't go to hospital, you won't die, right? You don't need to be PCR testing. This is a flu, and the symptoms are. But and then there are, which I won't go into, if you have coronavirus contamination from dog kidney in an influenza vaccine, which happened in 2017-2018 in America, and some of those influenza vaccines, if they have this dog kidney with coronavirus, that if the next circulating coronavirus comes, that of the American military, when they tested it, 1 in 3 of them, and people actually die of sepsis-like symptoms. They don't die of influenza, and you can die very quickly. You know it's sepsis, so you can die very quickly. So why I came out in May, because the Irish Medical Organization in 5th of May said they were recommending as some kind of a treatment for coronavirus that the total population of Ireland would get a flu vaccine, which had been known to have an issue with coronaviruses, with viral interference. But that year's one that was tested in the US Army, 2017-2018, normally they're made on chicken eggs, were made with dog kidney, which has coronaviruses. And you get this viral interference, or it's called immune system priming or super priming. And it's known that if you come across a virus like that, that anyone, no matter what age you are, when the next circulating similar virus comes, 1 in 3 people or more can have serious consequences, and can, like in the animal studies, the animals would all seriously ill or died, right? So that's why there has never been an RNA vaccine. Because in the animal studies, when they tested it on the ferrets and the animals, they were fine. But then when they exposed them to coronavirus, they all died. So, of course, the Irish Medicines Organization recommending a potentially corona-contaminated or part of influenza in the middle of a corona outbreak, where they had locked people in their homes and they were going to release the lockdown, you know, because the vaccine, after 2 weeks, your immune system would be primed. And I was saying that if you do that, the people, when they came out, would all start dying or be very sick, and that would be called the second spike. So I was calling it out when people were locked down, because they would be dying of sepsis, and it would be like nurses and people who had got the, you know, police. And so that if that was happening, that that was not a random event, you know, that it's well published, this viral interference priming, and that it would be immoral to be recommending a potentially, you know, influenza vaccine for corona when this viral interference is potentially 1 in 3 people for an illness that was not, you know, was very rare, that they would not kill anyone. So I can just give you, there is no need for the lockdown. There's no need for teenagers and people to be wearing masks. And if you do wear a mask, you will have psychologically, you'll have anxiety, you know, for teenagers. There's huge increases, there will be, in suicides. And there will be increases in diseases like pleurisy and pneumonia and chronic fatigue. But the worst thing is, and it makes sense, this is all common sense. When you have a mask on, you're rebreathing your air, so you don't clear your carbon dioxide. So you have very quickly, in America, 2,000 parts per million is the safe dose, above you can't work. But when you wear a mask, it goes up to 8,000, which is essentially, you know, parts per million. It's like 20, 30, 40 times. You get headaches, you get chronic fatigue. It's like working in a dangerous environment. You're not supposed to work in 2,000 if you were working in a room. And wearing the mask is the equivalent of working in a toxic carbon dioxide, and you have less oxygen. It suppresses your immune system. It also activates any latent viruses you have, so that you will be more sick for the next flu season. as well as, you know, 90% of communication is nonverbal. So you have, you know, loneliness and anxiety, and it actually subconsciously makes you stressed when you can't see people's expression, because your subconscious part of your brain doesn't really know what basis, whether they're, you know, friendly or not. You can't actually read the clues. So there's no need for lockdown. There's no need for not having churches. There's no need for social distancing. And it can all be gone overnight. So I think there's lots of things, right? So that's a societal issue. But I suppose, like, we never in the history of the world locked down any country for a flu that had a chance of dying of one in 1.82 million, right? So the thing is, what's shocking is, for 50 years, from an economist's point of view, that what happens after a lockdown, it was well known, is that you get a huge spike in unemployment, right? And a huge reduction in salary. And some people, so like in Switzerland, they said that for 3 months of the lockdown, this is well known, right? That on average, everybody in Switzerland, which is a very wealthy country, would have those exact 3 months would have a reduced life expectancy of 3 months, right? So for every month, and that was well known. But what they said, which was also well, so when I mean well known, known for decades in like economy, you know, economic journals, social science, is that the loss of life is not evenly distributed. The loss of life in Switzerland was one in 50 people who may not have had mental health or would have been exacerbated because of the isolation and the loneliness. And for one in 50 people, they would lose a decade of life for 3 months of the lockdown. And that's just around mental health. But of course, with unemployment, people lose jobs. And if you lose your job, you have like a 145% chance of having cardiovascular disease and a significant risk of cancer, because you lose money, you're stressed, you don't have. So it turns out that human interaction is really important. So like for mental health, you have to get 18 drugs at the minute, right, to have some kind of effect on depression. But of course, if you really wanted to have depression, which is when I'm hoping to retire next year and actually do some real good in the world, is that if people actually, if you communicate, so I'm saying what we should have a relationship with our doctors to put them on a notice of liability. I know it sounds harsh, but I'm going to try and facilitate this, that if you are a person that you want to be healthy, you don't want to take drugs, and you have an arrangement with your doctor through an app and put them on a notice of liability, that they have to give you or recommend the best treatment with the best outcome. So say for depression, it's well known that actually volunteering, you know, joining a community, a choir, actually can actually prevent a lot of the symptoms of depression. Now, obviously, in some people it won't, but that we need the doctor. So in this case, for the doctor, you could have a record then of, well, did he tell you about nutrition for influenza? Did he tell you that you could do vitamins? You know, did he give you inhaled steroids? Did he give hydroxychloroquine? And then you or your family would know, wait a minute, the doctor didn't give me that. So I think the bond with the doctors is, on a notice of liability, they have to offer you the best treatment. So in Ireland, if you were an elderly person at 95, and when the lockdown happened, you were not given any treatment, you were locked in your room, you got morphine and you didn't get oxygen, you didn't get, you know, social contact, you didn't get good food, you didn't get vitamin D, which means you can go out, and you didn't get hydroxychloroquine, that those doctors are not giving you the treatment that's well known. And if you are very sick, or you go from been functioning to maybe have dementia and then you're not functioning, that is like well established. So those doctors, you need to be assessed and said, did you give that person the best treatment? And even what I'm saying is, we can forgive them, right? But of course, we're now coming into another winter season, and you need to tell everybody in care homes and all people that your doctor has to tell you about this stuff. And if they don't, and you get sick, or if you're the family members, those doctors need to be held to account. And that's, you know, I think that's the kind of relationship, because I think this COVID-19 is undermining the bond that we have, you know, with the medical community.
Thank everyone. Now, whether you agree or disagree in part or whole with Professor Cahill, understand that she is one of the world's leading epidemiologists and immunologists, and she's had an impeccable career. Now let's see how long it takes before the critics try to destroy her. And in today's woke society, it's very easy to deplatform people and then to have all these sock puppets and agent provocateurs go to work on a person's reputation. I'll keep you in the loop on whether or not this very brave person is able to keep standing or is simply swept into the dustbin of history with so many other people wanting to tell the truth. By the way, wanting to tell the truth, today from a report, the New York Times reports 9 out of every 10 restaurants and bars in New York City can't pay their full rent. All right? That's directly related to COVID. And I'm going to talk just about some COVID issues for a moment here. Now, remember when the state said, and the federal government also, give a break to tenants, don't throw them out during this pandemic because they're not working, they don't have an income, it's not fair. And they were right to say that. But now that that time's up, and now the landlords are demanding all their back rent, in New York State at least, all the property tax, the common usage tax, and the utilities. 4 separate expenses for every month, and for some people that's 4 months they haven't paid anything. You're dealing, even with small little mom-and-pop stores, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Who's got the money to come up with that? So when they did reopen, 90% couldn't pay the August rent. That means that within the next 90 days, in all probability, most of those will simply file bankruptcy or just go out of business or exercise a good guy clause. By the way, a good guy clause means you can no longer succeed, so you give the owner, the landlord, 90 days. More often than not, it's 90 days. Depends upon the lease. And as long as you're up to date with all your bills, at the end of 90 days, you give what is called a broom ready, meaning it's broom cleaned. There's no mess, there's no damage, and you can walk away, and there's no personal liability. There's still corporate liability, but your corporation's probably out of money, and so it's really judgment proof. But a lot of people don't have that good guy clause. A lot of people have personal guarantees, and that will follow them. That means their home, their cars, a lot of assets they may have and still be struggling, now the landlord will go after. I believe that that is a terrible thing, and that the state governments, at the very least, within each state, should pass that no longer will a person's personal possessions be able to be attached with a lien for not being able to pay their bills. I think that is just a crime against humanity, especially since the landlords were greedy and unrelenting and didn't help the tenant in most cases. They want their money. But it also means that the real estate market, the commercial real estate market, will have its first major challenge. There have been minor challenges, 2000, 2008 to 2010. But you have to go back to Abe Beame being mayor back in 1970, and that's when the real estate market was just devastated. And as a city, we were in the beginning process of making changes with Mayor Koch coming in. And I think he did a good job. I thought he was a good mayor. But that was also the birth of Donald Trump's empire starting. And we see the results of that. In any case, what I see happening today is that the major landlords, many of whom have over-mortgaged their property, meaning much like the subprime people who had a house in 2006 and they bought it for maybe $100,000, it was worth $300,000. The real estate market was increasing far above the rate of inflation, maybe 1 to 3% a year maximum. Some places, like in Malibu, in Long Island, West Palm Beach, and in Tucson, Arizona, some of the gated communities, it was appreciating almost 50% per year. It's insane. And so people would say, now my house is worth, or condo is worth, $400,000, so I'm just going to take $300,000 off for myself. Well, you can do that, and the banks were happy to give you that money, but now you owe the bank $400,000. And you're assuming that the price of everything is going to keep going up, and that was the mistake. So landlords of big buildings did the same thing. I was in a building for decades, 2307 Broadway, and I know for a fact the landlord took what I consider substantial mortgage out on the value of the building. And what happens when the market crashes? Can they pay it back? or do they surrender the building? So you're talking about tenants living in buildings that could go bankrupt. What happens to the tenants? So we're going to have a complete reset of the entire relationship between commercial and residential landlords and tenants. And that's a good thing. It's not good that it had to happen because of a pandemic, because of all the other suffering, but it wouldn't have happened otherwise. So now the tenant at least has some negotiation power on their side. I'm already seeing real estate, commercial real estate drop by upwards of 50%. I can show you hundreds of places, beautiful storefronts, empty. 86 and Broadway on both corners, empty. Downstairs, where there used to be a D'Agostino's, empty. The same is true on Columbus and Amsterdam. Great locations, empty, because they were asking $200 to $300 a square foot. What little store, and none of these are big stores, what little store, 1,500, 2,000 square foot store, because there's another game they play. Let's say, and most tenants are not aware of this, let's say that you rent a store to put in a little bakery, and you rent a 3,000 square foot store. That's what you're charged per square foot. All right, let's say you're charged $250 per square foot times, 3,000 square foot. And how they do it is this. They'll take the total square foot, in this case 3,000, and then they times, let's just say for argument's sake, $300 a square foot, and you're looking at $900,000 a year, to divide that by 12, and you're looking at $75,000 a month rent. Who could afford that? No small business could afford that. And then on top of that, you have to pay property taxes. So that's probably another $15,000. So you're up to $100,000. Well, that's why 25% of all businesses, all small businesses in all five boroughs were empty before COVID. Now it's over 60% are empty. And it's going to get worse. I predict it'll be up around 70%. So now you can negotiate prime real estate for $100 a square foot, even less. And the landlord says no. And then 6 months later, okay, we'll do a deal together. So that's what's going on. And tenants who couldn't afford the high cost of these apartment buildings are now, they're moving out. And young people who don't have families more often than not are moving in, and working class people are moving back to New York City. And that's a good sign. So in the short term, things are going to get really bad. But in the long term, I see things becoming much like 1970 all over again, where instead of having a bank, a pharmacy, and a box store on a block, you're going to see maybe 5 to 10 small businesses. And that's what it used to be and was for almost 100 years. Or more. So a return to small community living and businesses in the boroughs is going to be happening over the next 5 years. Mind you, it took 30 years to create this monster of inequality, and COVID did it. Now it'll take about 5 years to fill up those stores. Just something that I thought was important to share with you. Now, also, there was a interesting story in The Intercept, and it was, as Joe Rogan's platform grows, so does the media and liberal backlash. Why? The popular podcast host is a political liberal by all metrics, so what explains the contempt he provokes in liberal circles? Glenn Greenwald. I'll just quote the first paragraph here. Joe Rogan has amassed one of the largest, most influential media platforms in United States politics, if not the single most influential. The value of his program was quantified in May when the streaming service Spotify paid a reported $100 million for the exclusive rights to broadcast his podcast. As one illustrative example of his reach, NASA whistleblower Edward Snowden appeared on Rogan's program 6 days ago, and the episode has already been viewed more than 5 million times on YouTube alone. The first time Snowden appeared on his program was last October, and that episode just on YouTube has more than 16 million views. To put that in perspective, the top-rated cable news programs are the Fox News shows hosted by Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, and they average about 4 to 5 million viewers, or 1/4 the number of views Rogan's discussion of Snowden generated. Rogan is rarely discussed in mainstream political and media circles, which raises its own questions. Why does someone who packs such a big punch in terms of audience size and influence receive so much less media attention than, say, cable news hosts with audience sizes far smaller than his? Presidential candidates certainly recognize Rogan's importance. All the major Democratic candidates, according to him, requested to appear on his show. The only ones he invited were Bernie Sanders, Tulsi Gabbard, and Andrew Yang. Rogan was in the news this week after President Donald Trump favorably responded to a guest suggestion that Rogan's host a four-hour sit-down presidential debate between the two candidates. The mere suggestion that someone like Rogan could host a prestigious and high-minded an event as a presidential debate prompted condescending scorn from established media precedents. Okay, those are all legitimate concerns. But if you've watched Rogan, he seems like a decent guy. He has a wide spectrum of people on his show. He has conservatives and he has liberals. And he allows people a chance to talk. It's a very laid-back, casual atmosphere. Nothing fancy about it. And he relates to a lot of people. There's just a lot of regular people that relate to him. Much like there's a lot of regular people that relate to Tucker Carlson. And Tucker's attacked the Koch brothers. He's attacked all the people in the media. He has attacked Lindsey Graham, who's a regular on Sean Hannity's program. Oh, yeah, he has no sacred cows. He's gone after everybody. Libertarians he's gone after. And he's a person who's not afraid to have people with difference of opinion on and debate them. Now, I disagree with Tucker Carlson on probably about half his major issues. Certainly on immigration, I disagree with him. But he also makes some very salient points. And the average person that is generally reasonable, they appreciate family and their culture and their history. They have a sense of meritocracy. Most people work hard, and they don't want to be demeaned for having done what they considered a good job, ethical job, and then be told that something's wrong with them because they're not of the right political or cultural or ethnic persuasion. Tucker gives them a forum. He's the only one I know that does. Everybody else has predetermined opinions, and boy, do they layer it on. So when you're looking at someone like a Tucker Carlson, at least, yes, you can say, I disagree with him on those, but he's allowing, for example, he allowed Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to come on to question the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Nobody else would. Nobody. I was the only other show that would have him on. And he will allow people to talk about the benefits of hydroxychloroquine, and that's good. No one else would. They would attack the people supporting hydroxychloroquine and zinc and azithromycin. He didn't. He gave them a forum. And he told the truth about, don't call this a mainly peaceful demonstration when hundreds of businesses are being burned, people are being attacked and physically assaulted and a person killed. Then what would be the motive of saying it was mainly peaceful? And it's not. There are peaceful demonstrations. There are certainly needs for peaceful demonstrations. But he's going to call them out. And that's why they're scared as can be of Tucker. So what they did, they all went towards trying to defund him. They tried to eliminate him. The trouble is, the more they tried to eliminate him, the more they attacked him, the more denigrating they went to go after him, the more popular he became. Now, having almost 5 million people watch you every night, and that's not the same 5 million people every night, so you've probably got an audience somewhere around 10 million people, more or less. That's huge compared to, the people on MSNBC and CNN. I mean, CNN, Anderson Cooper, you're dealing with a tiny audience, tiny, Rachel Maddow, tiny. Because they didn't show themselves to the public, in my opinion, of being objective, honest journalists. Instead, they were all pundits. They all had their opinion, and they used it like a soapbox every night and just screed after screed. And who wants to hear people who tear down everything, demean everything, are outraged by everything, and there's no sense of understanding the sacredness of life or that there could be another truth beyond theirs? So I think Joe Rogan is popular because he relates to the average working class person, comes across as one. Now, he has an interesting background, and he doesn't pretend to be something he's not. You know, he's just a regular guy broadcasting in a simple set, little cluttered set, messy set, but he asks some interesting questions, and he gives his guests, a wide variety of guests, a chance to talk. So maybe that's what Glenn Greenwald didn't get there, that there's a whole new type of person that the media has missed. This hit the sweet spot in America's consciousness. We'd like to hear people tell us the truth, unvarnished, not photoshopped for some ideological, political, or economic interest. That's why people want to know the truth about vaccines. Imagine this. Robert F. Kennedy went to Berlin, and 1 million people filled Berlin to hear him and some others talk about freedom of choice and the dangers of 5G and the dangers of going to a digital currency and the upcoming vaccines and the inherent danger in this new technology, RNA nanotechnology. That's 1 million people who came. Now, how many other people listened? And then how many people shared from that million to other people they knew that truth? Then you're dealing probably with 10 to 15 million people. Just that. These are people who are just regular people who are tired of being lied to by Angela Merkel and other people or heads of governments who care more about the sovereignty power of their government and nationalism than they do about helping their own citizens. That's why we attack Sweden. Sweden didn't follow any of our models of COVID. And gee whiz, they had a high death rate, and people didn't understand, or none of our media asked, why did you have a high death rate? Now, I considered inhumane, and you may disagree with this, but they made a decision that if our hospitals are limited in how many people can be treated, and especially our intensive care units, we have to weigh a decision. Who best would benefit? Those who are old, at death, with comorbidities, emphysema, heart disease, cancers, dementia, and they're going to die no matter what, or young people who still have a life ahead of them. So they made a decision. I consider it the wrong decision, but that's their decision. I understand why they made it, that let's exclude all sick people, old people. We're not going to treat them. Now, of course, they're going to die. If they can't go to the hospital and get their normal chemotherapy or diabetes medication, whatever treatment they were getting for their heart conditions, they're going to die. Now, they're going to die no matter what. They're just going to die faster, and they're going to die in larger numbers. So there's a big die-off, huge die-off, this big spike in deaths, and then, boom, it dropped. It dropped way down till now, with no closings and school and theater and dining and everything else. They ask for social distancing. They ask that your mask was optional, and they ask people not together in large groups, and the people were trusted to do that, and now they have maybe 1 death, 2 deaths per day, or no deaths on many days. So they're flatlined on coronavirus. They believe, and again, it's a belief, that because so many people were exposed to the virus, that their own natural immune system, which nobody ever talks about, and nobody ever gives any credit to helping us survive bacterial and viral infections, is because of our own immune system. And because the Swedish and the Nordic, the 8 countries in the Nordic circle, like Norway, for example, and Denmark, have a pretty healthy diet. They have a pretty healthy lifestyle. They like green time and outside, and kids have lots of play time and nature time. It's just a different way. They have a higher happiness index, less stress, that more people had what they call co-infections but without symptoms because their immune system was healthy, so they developed what they call a herd immunity. Now, you can agree or disagree with herd immunity. Most people agree with it within the scientific community, but there are those of us, myself included, who have our questions about herd immunity. But in any case, in places around the world that followed suit, you're seeing more people test positive and less people dying. But we're confusing and conflating the issue. We're saying, well, if you test positive, then you've got the virus that can kill you. Well, that's not necessarily true. You have a virus, but the body can tag it and destroy it. But if you're sick, then those people should be treated separately. They're the ones that need to be quarantined with special, and in my opinion, more holistic therapies that could not just prolong their life, but actually increase the quality of their life and frequently reverse their diseases. I've done it. Many others have done it. But that's not going to be followed. So that's why we've allowed the politicians, without the ethicists, to determine our public health policy. So I'm glad that Professor Cahill gave her voice to this. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you very much for listening, and have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying.